the Great Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a great cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the Great Cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Great Cricketer Podcast. On today's show, we're talking T20 World Cup, picking wrong-uns on TV and missed man-cads. We're talking Australia and South Africa, Agar hat-tricks and New Zealand's 10-wicket win over India in Wellington. Jimmy Neesham finally joins the show from across the ditch to talk Twitter, World Cups and who is his favourite and least favourite New Zealand-born all-rounders. This is all thanks to Budgie Smuggler, budgiesmuggler.com, budgiesmuggler.com.au. My name is Ian Higgins, and I'm sitting right here with Sam Perry. Pez, on the back of Ashton Agar's hat-trick, infamous hat-trick in South Africa, I want to know, have you ever seen a hat-trick? Have you bore witness to a hat-trick?
Good afternoon, Higgos, as we go to air. I saw you write this question down, and I sighed a little bit. Because I can only say the following out the side of my mouth. Mm-hmm. Taken to myself.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, like both in under 11s or under 12s or something. Okay. I hadn't realised I got the first one. It was one of those like last ball of the over. And
the
then
Murph Hughes hat-trick.
That's what we said afterwards. But yeah. I do remember like my dad pacing very quickly to the scorebook, and I remember thinking, he doesn't normally walk like that.
Hang on
and
a second.
Then later on, he informed me, and I honestly can't remember being part of or witnessing any other hat-tricks, and I've got no doubt that they actually did happen. It's just a shameful reflection of my own.
Wait, what was the second one?
Oh, just club cricket, yeah.
Yeah. How'd you get the third one?
I can't remember.
Were you buying your leggies?
Yeah, leggies.
That's hard to get a hat-trick as a leg spinner.
Yeah, yeah. Look, you know.
You, Warne. Yeah, Rashid Khan.
Exactly. Well, did they do it twice? I don't know. But I don't remember any other hat-tricks that anyone else took or being part of, which is, like I said, it's definitely happened. It's just a reflection of my own self-reflexive self-interest when playing cricket.
I got a double hat-trick once in the under 11s. See, this question's about me now. It's my turn.
Touché. You sat very patiently.
Yeah, yeah. Let him speak. Let him have a go.
Let him talk.
Let him have a go. I tell you, the hat-trick that I bore witness to when I was batting, though, we'll talk about that one.
First.
I was at the other end and watched all three balls, and the hat-trick ball was one of the best balls I've ever seen. It was against Parramatta. It was a third grade game.
It's nice. So adults.
Merrylands Oval. Mm-hmm. And this ball just like it bowled the guy on the front foot, leg stump just cut through. It was a tough wicket to bat on. And the satisfaction of being the not out batsman, seeing a hat-trick, just right. Like, come on, lads. Mm. Can you help me out here?
Yeah.
Can you get
the
behind
face
me?
That you can pull as that fourth batsman comes in as well?
What's he doing with it, Matt? I don't know.
Mate, just get forward.
I scored 99 that day.
What happened?
Their seventh bowler came on, and he bowled a half tracker, and I put it straight into mid-wicket's hands. Cool. So I remember that game very clearly.
Right. So far, yeah, you were at the non-striker for a hat-trick, you hit 99, and you've taken a double hat-trick.
Correct.
So you've done that quickly. So tell us about the double.
That's the end of the show. Should we get Neesham on? The double, it was with a two-piece composite ball on AstroTurf, under 11s, under 12s, something like that. And
you're being humble.
I don't really remember it. I was... Like that ball could swing. You could swing it both ways. You know that.
Oh, could you?
You know that film Crackerjack with Mick Malloy.
Yeah,
how he's like his ideal is to bowl a ball that goes both ways.
Right.
Yeah, I was doing that day, mate.
You were Crackerjack. I can't really remember. You know, it was an easy ball.
Let me tell you the entire spell. 14 overs, hot day.
That's right.
Hot day.
Remember the smugness that you felt as a kid, like explaining what a double hat trick was to people? We'd be like, what, it's 6 wickets in a row? No, it's actually 1, 2, 3, 2, 4.
It's actually 4, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Otherwise, what would you call 4?
You know, exactly. Your eyes are rolling in the back of your head as you talk to me.
I'm getting vertigo again. I actually want to get into vertigo in a second because I want to talk about the camera angles from South Africa when you watch cricket there. It's very disorientating. But before then, let's get into the Women's T20 World Cup.
I think so.
And let's get into the first match there at Spotless Stadium, Australia versus India. And Pez, as a leg spinner, I presume he could bowl a wrong-un. How obvious was it that Yadav was about to bowl 8 wrong-uns in a row?
Nah. I like that take. I see that take. I see it around Twitter, etc.
It's my take.
Yeah. It's a lot of people's take, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, you just pick it out the back of the hand, can you, on TV? That's pretty nice. Yeah. Well, we first, with Poonam, right? So Poonam takes 4 for. could have been Pfeiffer, but or was it Pfeiffer?
No, it was four.
It was four, yeah.
Four, yeah, and dropped hat-trick.
Dropped the hat-trick. We'll get to that in a second. Yeah. But the wrong one was the mainstay of her spell.
Yes.
And I learnt later on that they kind of held her back in the recent tri-series, and they held back, and she held back her wrong one
as well.
Oh, that's smart. So this, you know, this reminds me of, you know, when Warne held back his big leggy and his flipper in 93.
Yeah.
You know, when, you know, it was Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, we couldn't find them either.
Same thing.
You know what I mean? Held back.
Couldn't find them.
They've still been held back.
Where were they looking? Where were the US looking?
Anyway. But yeah, like picking wrong-uns is like one of the greatest examples of like cricketing phenomena where people think they're really good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're often not.
You're describing me.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I hope it doesn't trigger you too much. But it's like I think unless you're at the top level of men's cricket, mm-hmm. it's extremely difficult to pick a wrong-un or to play a wrong-un, even when you think you see it, because they don't happen very often, and the shapes that the bowler makes looks like a leg spinner. Mm. So even when you see it, or if you half see it, you're like, oh, I don't know where to like put my bat. Mm. So there's one.
But you're talking about like playing top level men's cricket. I just told you about my third grade 99.
Yeah, that's right. What I'm saying is, you wouldn't be able to play Poonam's wrong.
I mean, the pace was another thing.
Mate, I reckon the pace only looks bad in relation to like the cricket that you're used to watching as well. I reckon that pace is probably fine for the middle grades that you played.
Maybe. Do think about that.
I reckon Poonam. Yeah,
we went to the Junction Oval. We went to interview Elisa Healy that day for our seven thing, and I was watching the wicketkeeper practice that day, and I was like, she's legitimately very, very good, and she had an outstanding performance on Friday night. She's like legitimately good. So, but it is a hard thing when you're so trained to watching Australia, England, basically, you know, fast bouncy wickets, and then you watch like a different sport or the same sport performed by different people, and you're like, oh, is this the same? Yeah, it's not.
It was a great performance from Poonam, and people are like, oh, she's bowling wrong. And it's like, I just can't emphasize enough. Not only like is it difficult to bowl wrongs, to land them, then to face people who are consistently landing wrongs, even if you think you can see it. Often players say, and this is something that grade players or club cricketers won't have experienced, it's particularly difficult to read the direction a ball is spinning at night time as well.
Who said that? I'm talking about was it Ponting or was it Warne? No, talking about Rashid Khan.
Yeah, with the seam. Yeah. So it's really difficult to pick the seam. Some people just pick it with the way the ball's spinning in the air. Mm. So there's all that. I just loved seeing somebody bowling wrong and destroying people. Mm. It reminds me of like the best wrong and bowler I've ever seen, and I probably shouldn't relate it back to men, but Stuart McGill just had the meanest wrong. There's a story. I saw him in the Sydney cricket ground indoor nets bowl a wrong that bit the wicket so violently on AstroTurf that it spat up and split someone's chin open.
Oh my God.
That's how much he was extracting with his wrong-un. Like, it was literally a violent wrong-un, and it opened up someone's chin.
Fuck.
So I'm all for anybody who takes fourfers, fifers with wrong-uns. A note on the Indian keeper as well. I felt like that hat-trick catch was quite a difficult catch because the ball was slow enough that the deviation from the edge was significant enough that you couldn't just take it as though it was right there. I mean, you're a keeper.
Yeah, when I was playing in the World Cup, Pez. the one of the easier catches are when like someone's cutting on the back foot because the ball, the distance the ball has to travel that far isn't very far and often they're very small edges so your gloves are kind of already in. When it's front foot and the ball's still got to travel metre and a half, it deviates enough and you have no reaction time basically.
So unless it's a feather, you actually have to adjust your hands to watch the ball. So
yes, it's difficult. Anyway, mate, I hear all that. I see all that.
You see it, yeah.
I reckon Australia batted really badly, man. Mm. Like I don't just no get go. Like Healy got out. Healy batted well, 50 back in the runs, good. And then I mean, when someone takes what 4 for 20 or 4 overs, 4 for 15 or 4 overs, whatever it was, but Yadav took, it does decimate the innings, as actually the men saw in a similar capacity where they just like came in and it's hard to score runs quickly. I take all that. Don't think they played it very well and haven't played that well. Didn't play that well in the tri series. I mean, they won the thing, but now they've lost 2 out of the last 3 games against India.
Feel that pressure. We were WhatsApping during the match, and Beth Mooney was getting interviewed. And
she was being interviewed by Mel Jones. That's right, mate. Yeah,
an offhand remark she made.
Beth Mooney, she's actually commenting on the strength of the crowd, and she was like, "Oh, I was thinking when we're fielding, oh, this is only 20,000 people or whatever. I was thinking, oh, what must it be like for 90,000 people? They're already thinking about the final, and this whole thing's been built up."
Which isn't her saying we're going to make the final necessarily. It's just an offhand remark. Well, no, it's not. I mean, she's just saying imagine what 90,000 is like. But there's been so much talk about this 90,000. Like the inference with 90,000 is if they make the final. Now, I know in like official dispatches they do say that occasionally, but you wouldn't say it unless you thought we're an extremely good chance of being there, which they are.
Which they are, but, and remain so.
But they've got to win every match now. They've looked like they're a busted ass. They look like they're out of form. They're they're nowhere near the kind of that compelling force that they were 12 months ago.
Yeah. Well, England lost like 11 games during the World Cup in 2019, but they still won it. So it doesn't matter what happens. You just got to get yourself to a semi and then you roll in.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're staying on the theme of the World Cup.
Yeah.
And it is a theme, Pez. It's okay. The theme of the World Cup. Let's talk about England and Sri Lanka. South Africa is what I meant. South Africa in Perth. Was that last night? Night before. And one of the main talking points was a missed opportunity from Catherine Brunt to Mancad.
Yeah.
The batsman who then hit a six to basically to take the game away from England.
Batter.
Yeah. Got to get your pronouns right. And now it's like, now I've sort of flipped with the Mancad. Now it just has to be enforced because it's getting fucking silly now. Like
it wasn't enforced. Everything was enforced. What do you mean?
Well, there's like a theory of like, do you need to warn them?
And I've always... she didn't need to. She just chose to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so is it
easy? So what you're saying is I like this. Well, what you're saying is like, so what she's done is, what Catherine's done is missed the easiest run out she'll ever have in her life. What that should go down
had
as
three,
is...
Had three to aim at.
She had all three to aim at. She was right there. It was point blank. Batter was out of their crease and she still missed. And you have to, I mean, if you're enforcing, if you're just looking at the rules as they stand, it's just a run out opportunity. She's just running up to the stumps and someone's out.
Yeah, didn't have to throw
you'd
it.
You'd have to start asking corruption questions.
I will.
And I might. I mean, she's cost her team the game.
Do you know what I want to see eventually with the Mancad? You know Jonty Rhodes' famous run out where he dies at the stumps? Yeah. That's what I want to see
take
with a Mancad.
Yeah. Don't get into your bowling shot. Just run in and just dive
head first.
Well, I mean, because if the batter's so far out of the crease, they'll dive back. It'll be a huge,
It's a new spectacle to the game.
Mm.
It's a weird sport. It's a new sport. It's not cricket anymore. Yeah. It's just not cricket.
It's just funny how these professionals just seem a little bit conflicted about doing it, aren't they?
Well, it's...
Not all, but yeah.
Yeah, like in the prime Gilchrist years of his walking. And it was like then...
His prime walking years.
He was doing the Johnny Walker ads, I think. No, anyway, that was Justin Langer. Anyway, like it sort of... There was a bigger conversation about who was walking, who was a walker, who wasn't. Mm. Who's a man catter, who's not.
Yeah.
You know? Person catter.
Get out of here. Yeah. I feel it third person.
Yeah, I thought that as well. Yeah.
Nah.
Yeah.
Nah. Yeah, I don't know. I feel the same way as I did when we spoke about this a few weeks ago, really. And I think that instinct plays out with Catherine Brunt. I think it's fine. You know, she's just gone, don't do that. Come on, give us a break. And then got pogo.
But could have won the game for her team.
Cricket's a funny game.
It's a funny game. Truly funny. Haven't laughed in weeks. Pez, New Zealand won their first game against Sri Lanka. Also in Perth. Oh, it's actually nice to see cricket back at the Wacker. Because it's all the memories. All of my memories are there. They're not at Optus Stadium.
Yet.
Yeah. Sponsor of Asher. Now that I say that. Mate, what about Thailand, though? Thailand lost their first game against West Indies. They got 9 for 78 off their 20 overs. They weren't bowled out. That's a moral victory for the Thais, surely.
They had the West Indies 4 for shit.
Did
4
they?
For not many, yeah, at one point. Interesting. But, well, it reminded me, actually, obviously great to see Thailand there, and they're doing the bowing stuff to all four corners of the ground and whatever, but... you would have seen during the week that New Zealand played them in a trial match. New Zealand defeated them in the match conducted an impromptu coaching session. And I just was, you know, like the sick-mindedness in me was like, well, there can't be any sweeter victory than that. You know what I mean? Like,
how much do you need to decimate another team?
The whole thing, like the whole coaching session was delivered sarcastically. In so many ways, it was really like Germany or one of those European teams talking to the Jamaicans in Cool Runnings. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. That's how I saw it when I saw it with the volume down, you know, giving a boy dinner and whatever. Like, oh, look at this. Like, they beat them, they destroy them, and now they're coaching them. It doesn't get much better.
Imagine the satisfaction of like beating a fourth grade team outright and then just like going to their dressing room after the game with a couple of beers and just like, you know, you guys are up and comers, you know, you got a lot ahead of you. You know, just stick with it, you know. Maybe pick your battles a bit more, change the field a little bit, bold your plans, you know, set a field.
This is why I've always said Jesus was the ultimate alpha. You know, like I heard, I mean, in a related point, like I... through the week, someone was telling me that, or as my wife was telling me, a colleague of hers is a surgeon, and she often has to, she has had to treat terrorists. And some of them have been quite disparaging of her for being a woman or whatnot. Sure. And she continues to treat them. And, and I'm like, well, you know, that's really like, you know, killing them with kindness. You know what I mean? Yeah. Not killing them, but, you know, really treating them with kindness. Well, you know, Jesus was the ultimate alpha. Forgiveness is the ultimate alpha play. That's what New Zealand's doing.
We're on New Zealand theme anyway, show.
Yeah. And our sponsor this week's Hillsong.
And Ferg Burger. Bez, let's get into the South Africa-Australia T20 series. I'll just wrap up the Women's T20 World Cup. Too early to call. Some teams have only played one. Most teams only played one game. Australia have lost their opening game, but Australia's still heavily favourites to win.
I don't think so. That's
who you
call.
Got?
Yeah.
Who you got?
India.
They're third favourites. I think England are second favourites.
Well, I mean, Australia, if they beat New Zealand now, it would appear as though they'll play India again in a semi. And in my experience, you don't learn how to... I mean, if Australia playing India and playing spin against India has taught us anything over the last 30 to 100 years, you don't learn how to play a ball that you can't pick in 3 weeks.
That is an issue, yeah. Maybe they might shift that semi-final to a day match.
Well, you know what will happen? You're just going to get a bunch of Australian men, dinosaurs, who are pundits coming out and saying, just get them on the full. Just charge.
I did find it funny, like Michael Clarke being on commentary for that, like just some of the fastest feet ever in men's cricket. Watching someone decimate us bowling 45k an hour leg spinners.
She takes 4 for 15. She still managed to.
Not saying she bowled badly. Slow over eight, trying to get the ball down the other end.
With that double bouncer, just to talk about that quickly. Yeah. Would it, like the way that would have been better is if the second bounce had happened before Gardner took a swing and actually spun on the second bounce. Like, oh, I've actually done that before.
When it goes behind
point. But you get more spin on the second bounce when you actually really jam it into the wicket. But anyway, nearly bounced three times, actually. Just caught that the base of the stump. But anyway.
Mate, cricket's changing.
4 for 15. That's leg spin, man. That's McGill stuff. He's like, okay, I'll bowl you some shit. I've also taken 4 for. Anyway.
Yeah, and you meet professional athletes and they're just bigger than what you think.
Yeah.
McGill's thick. 2 C's. He's thick, man. He's thick through the hands. His shoulders are thick. His hips are thick. And I know this because I see him regularly.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, same with Warne. Warne's enormous hands. You had an experience with Graeme Smith, the South African opening batsman.
The back just didn't end. Great Wall of China, but for backs. He was getting a massage too. They have a massage at the Oval. Anyway, insiders. Welcome to insiders.
Men's T20 series over there in South Africa. Australia won the first game by a million runs. And I thought, well, we'll never lose again.
This is what the score will always be forevermore.
Just like in an India series, that one match India series. Mm-hmm. And then Australia lost last night in a bizarre match. Where the wicket looked flat as fuck when De Kock was batting. He got 70 early on. He was hitting like balls on the up, back down the ground, off Cummins. Just looked real. And then like the wicket seemed to slow and change pace a little bit. And what did we lose by there? 12, 15 runs?
12 runs. So
despite Warner opening the batting and being not out, scoring 67.
They're chasing 154.
Right.
They're 1 for 98 off 12.2 in the 13th over. So they need 56 off 46 with 9 wickets in hand.
Nine wickets in hand.
They lose by 12 runs, so not even close,
not
realistically,
even
and they're 6 down.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, it's fucking 98.
What's that?
You know those one days when it's like the team would finish on like 3 for 198, and it's like, it's going to be tough for 50 overs.
Yeah.
And then the other team gets 7 for 180.
Well, it's almost like they're so committed to this like concept of taking it deep, they just took it way too deep. Went, oh, shit, game's over now.
Boys, if we're batting the 20th over, we're going to win this game.
Well, it was just like, oh, if you need 12 off two, just 2 sixes.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, nah.
Yeah, that's actually quite hard in cricket.
Anyway. They go to Newlands next, so back scene of the crime.
No demons there. It's like India facing Australia facing Indian spin. No demons. No demons.
Nice.
Mate, the batting lineup's weird because I feel like they're trying to give Kerry a hit at any opportunity.
I saw that.
He batted 4 in this game when he was listed to come in at 6 or 7, and it was because when he was playing the T20s here in Australia against Sri Lanka, just didn't get a hit because Warner just couldn't get out, and we were smashing them, and everything was going great. And so this batting lineup's strange. Wade, Marsh, Carey in the sort of middle order. It doesn't.
Yeah, they're missing Maxwell. Everything looks good with Maxwell.
True.
That just the letters around in T20 cricket. Let's forget all the other stuff. Maxwell T20 cricket. He's just that mainstay. I need to see him in the middle of the scorecard, and that's the safety that I feel.
Yeah. What about Stoinis? I mean, we've lost one game there for almost changing the entire team.
I saw he got injured the other day, and he had to pull out of the Australia-England Lions match, and they're getting pumped in that game too, by the way. But
Pattinson's got pulled out of that game as well.
Yeah, so Stoinis needs to bowl to get involved, really.
Does he? But Mitch Marsh isn't bowling.
Isn't he?
No, I think so.
Okay. Oh, that surprises me. Yeah. I thought he would have been bowling.
He hasn't been bowling. He didn't bowl much in the Big Bash. He bowled a little bit in the Big Bash, but not a lot.
Yeah. I guess your point is, like, still...
Who's a better batsman, Stoinis or Mitch Marsh for T20s?
What role are we talking? It's role. It's all about role players. Six. Probably six. Marsh at this stage, because Stoinis hasn't batted there in ages. Stoinis can't really rotate the strike. He's just a big hitter. Yeah. He opens, you know? And I like it.
Mm.
There's just a couple of guys are doing that quite well at the moment.
Mm. Wade, is he in your top team? A pretty good Big Bash.
I'd say he's reserve bat.
Have you got a Darcy Short spot in your heart?
Third, fourth cab.
It's all a bit it, yeah. Mm.
Third, fourth cab. Fuck me. Fucking Bill Simmons cast here.
What about Ashton Agar's hat-trick in that first game?
Well, here we go.
He's locked in for now a year.
It's good to see that he's done something good.
Mm.
Well, with respect to Ashton. Mm. I guess it sounds quite
disrespectful. They want him to do well, and he did well in this
game. Well, he's the project player. At the moment, isn't he, Agar? He has been for a little while. He's been the project player.
Mate, talking about guys who are fucking athletes, that he's rig.
Well, this is what I'm going to say. Like, he's like the footy player who like tests through the roof. You know, he tests well. He's levers, athleticism, versatility. He's a young prodigy. Like if he was in the NAB draft, the AFL draft, he'd go high.
Yeah,
you know
right.
I mean?
Okay.
He's a high draft pick.
And he's got a brother who's doing good.
He's
things
coming through.
Well.
It's a good sporting family kind of thing. Stuff, that did something good when he was young. And but now he's done something. Is that the number one draft pick has performed in the match and. We're going to get excited. So, congratulations. From all reports, a lovely fella. So.
Good feel.
Sorry.
Big hands. Talking about big hands. Jesus.
Again, I mean, it's a given, isn't it? So, when you say someone in international cricket's got big hands, you're saying big hands relative to international cricket?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, enormous hands. Mate, what about New Zealand just absolutely decimating India? And it's more or less the same team who Australia have just absolutely pumped in Australia. I think it was either Pete... Lawler or Bredig, one of them on Twitter was just saying like this is getting a bit silly whether just the home team just wins. India, extremely strong team on paper. New Zealand, relatively similar team who came out here. I mean, they had Southie and Bolt back, to be fair, but...
what does that mean about our side against India last year then?
I don't remember us playing a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, what game? What are you talking about? Yeah. No? What, when Smith and Warner were there? We smashed them.
Yeah. You're talking about the Steve O'Keefe series? Well, we went close. Close. What's now known as the Steve O'Keefe series.
It doesn't bother me. It's good to see. I'd like. It's good to see the top dog lose for me, and it's good to see New Zealand win some games.
Mm.
And I like seeing New Zealand play in their home wickets, and it contributes to the richness and the variety of cricket. It means that there's still opportunities for people to do well with different disciplines and different styles against players that are meant to be the biggest guns in the world. Good stuff.
Are they using the Kookaburra? No, they're using the Duke, I think.
No idea.
The readers, they're using the composition ball. Swings both ways. No surprise that Kane Williamson in New Zealand's 348 hit 89, leading the charge there. Mate, what about Kyle Jamieson playing his first test?
Nice.
We spoke about him a couple of weeks ago, or during the Boxing Day series when he was brought in when New Zealand had 85 injuries. And he's this massive unit. He's the height-based selection. Picked up 4 wickets in the first innings, doing the job.
Yeah.
Fresh blood.
Australians will always get behind a height-based selection, won't
they?
You know,
always.
It's just a big rig. If two things are equal otherwise, just get the big fella in. And that's what they've done. They've got the big fella in, and this is a way to really disparage all the other skill that he has.
Yeah.
And he's just knocked over Pujara and Kohli in successive overs. So.
Who's the biggest guy we can pick in the team?
Yeah.
When you see the other team warm up at a game of cricket, you just notice the height
Absolutely.
Of people. What about when people used to measure run-ups with tape?
Yeah.
With like a measuring tape instead of just like turning around and counting back 23 steps or whatever.
Well, there's all sorts of things you could... I mean, I particularly remember the height thing and then later in, like as a child and then into pubescence, like if someone had a beard as well.
Yeah.
And you would watch very closely how they warmed up. And you're like, oh, he looks fast or whatever. And invariably the warm-up deliveries of players on the side wicket rarely correlate to what they actually bowl in a match.
Rarely.
I just tend to find like you can barely deduce anything. You'll still watch though.
Yeah.
Just to see, oh, geez, he's got a quick arm action. Oh, he
do
looks
you do the
right.
thing where like you're not watching because you don't care. You don't care what these blokes do, but you're watching. So you can't just like stand there and just like stare at the opposition warming up and bowl. But even though of course you can, but it's weird. The fuck are you looking at, mate?
Well, it got strange into like, I think it really peaked at like rep underage cricket at like sort of under 16s or 17s where like someone could really come onto the scene and be really quick and a bit more developed than everybody else. Whereas when you got into adult cricket,
the same
you're in like, I mean, you would have experienced this in the sort of high grades, but I've never gone there. But, you know, when you're playing the middle grades or lower grades, you wouldn't really look because if anyone was good, they wouldn't be there on that day. They would be at a different ground.
You're still interested in, like, who the people are who are going to bowl the ball, who's going to get you out.
But if so, but you wouldn't, have that visceral fear of, like, oh, he bowls wheels, because if he bowled wheels, he wouldn't be playing force. You know what I mean? Like, so he can't be good by definition. He could be good relative to us, but he's not going to be take my head off good.
So you're saying, like, when you faced Bollinger, for instance, and you're watching him walk, oh, this bloke's pretty quick. Well, yeah. Who's his left arm?
Well, look, you know, once you get to that level, you sort of know the guys anyway. So. I'd watched him on TV. And then when he was running into bowl, I was thinking, this is like TV.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Played Bollinger. Look at me now.
Let's talk about some other stuff in world cricket. The West Indies are about to embark on a 5-match ODI tour of Sri Lanka. Darren Bravo back in the squad. What about Bangladesh in Zimbabwe? One test series over there. Captain Craig Irvine, 107. Not sure if it's related to Sean. You ever play against Sean Irvine? I think you played some club cricket in Australia. Actually, now I think about it, might have been in Western Australia, but he was an extremely angry man.
I didn't play against him. He played Shires cricket. I remember that. Oh, yeah, that's right. He wasn't even playing grade cricket. A pretty, I don't know what sort of flex that is. It's a good one, though. Zimbabwean test cricketer playing Shires.
Yeah. Extremely angry guy.
Was he?
On the field. Mm-hmm. On the field. Anyway, he hit 107 for Zimbabwe.
Well, Craig did.
Not Sean. Sean isn't. He was playing twos Shires. anything to follow on the Sheffield Shield that starts today?
Not really. You've got down here that the point system looks weird and scary.
Yeah.
I think New South Wales are going well. Victoria has beat them in the last round, so they need to win every game to make the final, which they've done for like the last 6 years, so they'll find that difficult.
Right.
I saw Dan Hughes was on 90-odd not out at lunch as we go to air, but otherwise it's sleepy as we suggested it was last week, I think. And then the other one was that the England Lions are out here. So basically both sides' second team is playing at the moment, the MCG, and England made 420-odd.
Right.
Sibley hit 100. Someone else made 100. And
what's Sibley playing for? He's just played in the Test Series.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll probably just get used to playing in Australia.
Yeah.
And Swepson took 3 for. Otherwise, they made 400, and then Australia were 5 for 100 overnight. So, and like Khawaja hit 30 off 30 overs or something like that. Moses hit a breezy 25, and everyone else was ordinary. So England win the next 5 Ashes series.
But can they retain them? It's the main question. Pez, we're about to speak to Jimmy Nation on the phone.
Yeah, very excited.
How excited are you?
I'm very excited. I mean, you know, this is one of the most requested guests.
Yeah.
And a guy that, and see from my intro, is I'm excited because he strikes me as very normal. Which is rare, paradoxically.
That's why I don't trust
cricket.
I want to find the demons. What's going on underneath? Lift the lid.
So I'm looking forward to that. Yourself?
I'm very much looking forward to it because I think we've tried this for over a year. It just hasn't lined up for whatever reason. He's always been very good and kind, but just hasn't lined up. He's actually playing a match at the moment, isn't he?
He is. He's on day three of a 4-day
of a match. Oh, yeah, I'll do the Great Cricketer podcast at night. Yeah, okay. But I'm actually
can I just say, I've looked up the scores just as we go to air again, and they made 300 on the first innings. He made 60. I was last man out, and the opposition was 600. I was like 6 for 600 or something. So
why does this keep happening in first class cricket? I think that happens all the time in Shield cricket. I'm a little bit anxious to talk about like probably the worst moment of his professional career, losing the World Cup final. I'm anxious about that.
Are you going to make yourself do it anyway?
For entertainment. Yeah. Yep.
Nice.
Well, let's see what happens.
It can be hard to leave grade cricket. The relentless nudity, champing and macho horseplay can have a debilitating lasting effect.
Hi, darling. How was your day?
Yeah, not bad, bud.
Can you please stop calling me bud?
So when you do call time on your 8-year, barely memorable career, you need all the help you can get. That's why we started the Grade Cricket Rehabilitation Centre. Using state-of-the-art cognitive behavioural therapy, the Grade Cricket Rehabilitation Centre will help you reintegrate back into normal society just like your family wanted.
Hello, darling. How was your day?
Good, thanks. And how was yours?
It was wonderful. You're coming along so well.
Yeah, cheers, champ. Oh, wait. Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
The Grade Cricket Rehabilitation Centre. There is a way out of this.
Here goes, we got there. The guy we have on the line,
asked that we not interview him until after the recent series against Australia, and rightly so, I think. In his own words, he hits a little white ball with a stick. And recently, after a particularly disappointing, some would say galling, others say invalid result, he also said, kids, don't take up sport, take up baking or something, die at 60 really fat and happy, which he then went on to take back in a Guardian article. But once you say something on Twitter, you're bound to defend that position for life, lest you be seen as weak. Anyway, he's quite clearly one of the most normal blokes on the international men's sporting circuit. There's been a lot of hype in the last 24 hours about this chat. It's New Zealand international, Jimmy Neesham. Jimmy, welcome to the Grey Cricketer Podcast.
G'day, guys. Pleasure to be here.
Lovely to have you on. Mate, it's a bit of an unusual context for this chat. Most of the time when we ask for players, like, there'd be no way you'd get a look in if they've just played or if they're in the middle of a game. It'd be sort of, you know, sorry, bud, we're in a playing phase, we've got recovery, etc. But you've been good enough to make yourself available after the third day of a four-dayer for Wellington. Maybe just let us know how the game's going and how the day's play went.
I'd rather not, to be honest. we've just... it's been 155 of the best in the dirt fielding, so the legs are a little bit tired, but we're out in Rangiora down about half an hour north of Christchurch down in the South Island, so there's not a whole lot of stuff to do here apart from do interviews, so you guys are obviously got lucky.
Yeah. Oh yeah, but you got a couple of interviews lined up for tonight or something?
Yeah, I got an interview with the Macca's drive-through window in about half an hour.
Well, speaking of both of those things, you know, like a whole day in the dirt and Macca's drive-through, like, you're the only other Kiwi international we've spoken to on this show is Will Somerville, but yeah. He played grade cricket in Sydney. So, for the benefit of the listeners and you know, in the theme of this cast, like, can you sort of run us through a club or district cricket team in New Zealand? Like, if we were to walk into the sheds at a club or premier cricket team, what are we going to find?
I've played for so many. There's such a variant, I guess. But not often the Macca's window, I suppose, after a hard day in the field. It'd normally be a couple of boxes of Heineken's or something, or whatever the team's favourite drop is. And I'm looking outside. It's still light outside, so probably not quite any nudity yet. But probably in the next half hour or so, I'd imagine that'll start going off.
If we can, we can skip right forward, Jimmy, to your... Just your test career, you know, 100 on debut, then becoming the eighth person ever in international cricket to score 200s in the first two test matches. You're also batting with Brendan McCullum during the famous innings of when he got his 300. I mean, first question, what advice did you give him when you were on debut when he was on about 299?
Me and Dad actually played a fair bit of cricket together before that even, so... we were reasonably good mates, and I was lucky enough, I guess, to bring up my 100. I think he was maybe on 297 or 298 when I brought up my 100. So I sort of, you know, went down to him and touched gloves and said, there you go, mate. I've paved the way for you. So
you're welcome.
Sort of take it from here. And it was in front of, it must have been the biggest crowd the Basin Reserve's seen in however long. So it was a pretty special occasion. And then obviously to back it up in West Indies and Jamaica a few months later was obviously a pretty surreal experience. But there's been a fair bit of water under the bridge since then, certainly.
Sure, yeah. I mean, at the time though, were you thinking like, geez, test cricket's actually not that hard. It's actually pretty easy, a couple of hundreds in the first two tests. You're thinking like, oh yeah, I'm paving away here for a 20-year career test level?
Yeah, it's funny actually looking back. I sort of think I was a kid really back then. I think I was 23, 24 during those tests, so probably an adult by normal job standards. But I think, kid cricket-wise, and I was a bit, strung up on the game, I guess, bit of a perfectionist. And the funny thing is I tell some of the younger guys in the Wellington team these days that I actually don't even remember bringing out my 100 in the second test in the West Indies. I just remember... being in the change room, being really frustrated with how badly I thought I'd batted. And so now I sort of talk to them now when they're coming through about like trying to enjoy the game more and enjoy the moment and that sort of thing. Because, you look back now and, I mean, obviously I don't know what my future holds in Red Bull cricket especially, but there's a decent chance that it'll be sort of the only go I got at Test cricket. And to not really even be able to remember one of the best moments is a bit frustrating, but... hopefully, while there are a few really good moments in white ball cricket as well, and hopefully a few more to come as well.
I'm sure there will be more excellent white ball memories, but we have to quickly cover the World Cup here. I'm sure it's probably a painful topic of conversation, but I still feel it's probably quite raw. I'm not even from New Zealand, but and I know that you did say that hurts. Hopefully there's a day or two of the next decade where I don't think about that last half hour before congratulating England and graciously saying it was well-deserved, which I personally slightly disagree with. But I just sort of follow up. has there been a day where you don't think about that last half hour since you wrote that?
No, definitely not. I think, it's a funny one. We sort of talk amongst the guys, obviously play domestic cricket and play against a few of the guys that are on the squad and, it's one of those things that kind of doesn't escape you, really. I think people say, it's just a game and all that kind of junk and, you know, get over it. But, yeah, it is one of those things that I do find myself sort of standing in the field, you know, even in a day's play today and sort of looking around and just thinking about the Super Over and that sort of thing. It's, it's not really a thing that leaves you in a hurry. But, I think definitely for the guys that were involved at the very end in the crunch time, it's probably going to be a bit more difficult to get over. But it's one of those things, I'm sure it all sort of slowly eases with time.
Because you left the World Cup straight away at the end of that and you played in Canada. Is that right? You played in is it a T10 or a T20 series over there? I mean, it must have just been just a massive circuit straight away after that.
Oh, yeah, the greatest.
Canada circuit.
Yep. It was... I wonder if I'm allowed to, I was just going to say it. Yeah, probably in the month after the World Cup, probably had about four sober evenings. So I actually spent about a week in England just on holiday, sort of going around. I actually went up to Liverpool and watched the Netball World Cup final because one of my flatmates was playing for New Zealand and that, so I thought I'd better... You know, it's hard to avoid it when they go, oh, you're only an hour away by train, you should come watch. Yeah, I got nothing, but no, I'm not doing anything. So I had to go watch, and then went straight to Canada and had three or so weeks there with a bunch of really good blokes. Sort of tried to get over the World Cup, really. And I think it was actually a really good thing to do because it was still playing cricket, but it was also less meaningful, I guess, and more of a chance just to go out and express yourself, which is... I suppose a more politically correct way of saying have a slog.
Yeah, it must have been quite cathartic. Yeah, I've got a page in my phone in my notes called Nisha's tweets. Don't go through my phone. And there's been actually a few responses to our promotion of you being on the show, and actually someone actually wrote, can he just reply to the questions through tweets? So you've obviously got a huge online presence. But I'll just go through a couple here. August 2019, you tweeted, it's been a hell of a month to be a Kiwi-born all-rounder that's not me. Obviously referring to Ben Stokes. I mean, so do you thank Ben Stokes for moving to England so you could have a prosperous international career for yourself, or hate him, for cheating his way to a World Cup victory against the nation of his birth?
Yes, that was a good run-on sentence at the end there.
Commentary, too.
I reckon we'd make a great combo, me and Stokes, in the same team, to be honest. Him at five, me at six. Obviously, he's one of the most destructive bats in the world right now, and I think my record with the ball was probably a little bit better than his. So I think if we had a combo sort of sharing five or six overs each and batting in the middle, I reckon that would have been great for New Zealand, especially because it would have meant that he wasn't playing for England in the final, which would have obviously skewed things a little bit more our way. But it's funny how things like that work.
There's also another tweet from June in 2019, during the World Cup as well. You actually tweeted an image of you throwing a pair of gloves into the crowd. And when I saw that, the joke that I came up in my head was, did Kane Williamson know that those were his gloves? And then I saw on your you had actually tweeted that about a few minutes later, to which you had to then apologise for people who didn't get the joke. So I just want to know what it's like to deal with great blokes on the internet.
Yeah, it's it can be frustrating at times, obviously, when something like that happens and you're having a bit of a laugh, and people obviously take it literally. But every now and then you sort of put out an apology, but only when people are starting to get really riled up. The one that really probably grinds me a little bit is when you say something, and then 6 months later something will happen and someone will... You know, send you a photo of your tweet and go, what about now? And you sort of think, it's just, I couldn't imagine being like a stand-up comedian, being Ricky Gervais or someone like that, and having people constantly remind you of acts you did 5 years ago or whatever. But look, I think social media, you have to have a thick skin if you want to put anything out there, really. And my mute and block buttons get a fair bit of a workout. especially when some certain teams are touring New Zealand. But we'll let that go.
That's going to be our new business proposal. But anyway, I'm actually just thinking about like relations across the ditch, like between Australia and New Zealand and Twitter, something I think about a lot. Seems to be like a distinct difference in how both countries approach it. Say in Australia, we have Ricky Ponting, who's just joined with a very clean presence. You know, he says Ricky Ponting, AO, Order of Australia, family heavy. The copy is cautious and tight, clean sponsor tie-ins. And on the other hand, you know, you, Jimmy Nation, will cop 38,000 likes for a scissor, paper, rock debate and openly sledge Virat Kohli for not scoring runs in the Ashes. And then, you know, it goes to the highest levels. Like our Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, was got in trouble in 2018 for an 11-second meme showing Conservative MPs raising their hands to Fat Man Scoop's 2006 track Be Faithful. Whereas, you know, Jacinta Ardern was this week praised on Twitter for a no-look pass of a bottle opener with the receiver saying it was pro as hell, what a fucking G. So I guess my question is, you know, what do the Aussies need to learn from you guys about social, you know, and just being normal and good people in general?
I'm just thinking about which section of that question to answer. The funny thing is, it's all a bit of a storm in a teacup, really. The Kiwis and the Aussies get along really well. And I actually, when I got picked up in the IPL this year, obviously because it was in the middle of the night, I rolled over and looked at my phone, and the only reason I knew I got picked up was because Glenn Maxwell had actually texted me saying, yeah, mate, this is going to be fun. And that was when I looked on, you know, online and saw that we've been picked up by the same team. So there's definitely a good relationship between a lot of the guys, I think. Australian cricketers are kind of genuine celebrities. You know, they earn, you know, millions of dollars a year and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's easy to get caught up in that sort of hype, whereas the Kiwi guys, you know, we earn less than a good, you know, mid-sized accountant. So Jet Raval got a bachelor for the company he worked for in the winter on the back of his bat, you know, that sort of stuff. So I suppose it's a little bit easier to stay humble when you know, you've got the crappiest house on the street in Auckland and all that sort of stuff, driving a Mazda.
I mean, you say that, but you have just said that you slipped through the IPL auction. So, yeah. I mean,
is that true? You're literally asleep. Yeah. No, do I pick up? Grab
a plane. Oh, Maxi, yeah, go on then. Yeah.
Well, I was in bed. It was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. So, I mean, you can't stay up watching TV, you know, killing your life.
Yeah.
All that to not get picked up and then just go to bed really angry.
Yeah, good point.
One of the things I'm the most fascinated about, Nation, and we'll call you Nation now, is that you're just really normal. You're a really normal person. Obviously, just talking down the phone now, just well spoken, erudite, polite, just normal. And I was reading about your story and like being dropped after the Champions Trophy in 2017, and you were really close to packing it in, and then you sort of worked as an intern, I believe, in a marketing capacity.
Yep.
And I sort of wonder, you know, you were so close to getting out of the game. Like, why do you keep playing?
It pays a little bit better than being a marketing intern. I think cricket's a tough sport, and it's a tough sport for resilient guys. And I think I just sort of got to the end of my tether, really, with the game. And there's so much stuff you have to deal with behind the scenes that, you know, members of the public don't understand or will probably never understand. And all that sort of stuff just really got to the end of my tether, and I just sort of decided that I was done with it and wanted to try something else. And I think, ironically, working a different job, it sort of alleviated any kind of fear of retirement or fear of getting dropped, because I've never really had a proper job before. Those are the sort of thoughts that go through your mind when you're going through a lean trough and first-class cricket or whatever. You're thinking, geez, I actually need to make this work, because, you know, I can't get a real job because, I mean, I can't hold a conversation. So you really put a lot of pressure on yourself to perform. And I think for me, you know, having 6 months or 5 months at a normal job and actually really, really enjoying it, it sort of removed that fear for me of what would happen if I failed. And I sort of slowly got the itch back for first-class cricket over that time. And I was very fortunate. One of my really close mates, Michael Bracewell, was a captain at Wellington at the time, and we'd talked about what I was going through, and he basically convinced me to come down to Wellington and give it a crack. And I sort of just thought, why the hell not, really? You know, it's 6 months playing a sport, give it a crack, see what happens. Worst case scenario, doesn't go well. I can retire with the peace of mind of knowing that I gave it everything I had and sort of move into that post-cricket world. And sort of, I think that kind of attitude really allowed me to I suppose, rediscover, you know, the cliche of the love of the game and not playing so much for runs or wickets, but just playing because I enjoyed being around a great bunch of guys and having a few beers after a game and all that jazz. And, you know, before I knew it, I mean, it was so quick. It was really only, I think, 3 or 4 months from moving to Wellington to then getting picked for New Zealand again and then obviously going really well and going to the World Cup and it all sort of snowballed from there. So it certainly, I don't think it was really a decision to, you know, I really want to play international cricket again. It was just a sort of a decision to why not give it another crack and it all sort of went from there.
Hey, that sounds incredibly sensible and really enlightening as well, because I was sort of reading at the time that I think when you were dropped in 2017, you sort of had like 6 different batting coaches and experts and all these people in your ear and stuff. And then, you know, it sounds like you were sort of went through a bit of a transition of just being really happy and comfortable within yourself and your own life. And then, you know, just a couple of years later, you're fucking hitting Jofra Archer for the cleanest ball over mid-wicket in a, you know, in a super over final. I mean, it just sounds like it's all sort of come together over the last few years. Obviously, like there's still, you know, you're 29, so you've got years left in your career, but it just seems like you're sort of really happy and at peace with yourself. Would that be fair?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a massive challenge for, I sort of talk about in the Black Caps environment how your top guys like Ross and Kane and Tom Latham and those guys, they're actually playing a different game from the sort of bottom half of the team.
Right.
Because they can sort of genuinely, they can have a couple of bad games and nick off a couple of times and they sort of know their spot secure and they have time to kind of work through technical issues or whatever and they know they'll get another game. Whereas when you're sort of on that periphery, every innings is, it can be actually crucially important for your career. So it's very hard to make any progress technically to sort of work on a problem because your most pressing concern is always the next game. How am I going to score runs in the next game to keep my spot? And sometimes you sort of lose, you know, sight of the bigger picture, which is the actual direction your game's going in, and you start chasing your tail a little bit around technical things. And I mean, it even happened to me a couple of weeks ago or a week or so ago. I came back from the ODI series against India and I'm fortunate enough to have a guy I work with in Auckland who I've worked with since I was a teenager, and I sort of checked in with him for a bowling machine session. He just said, "Mate, what the hell are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Mate, what's going on with your backlift? Why are you like double pumping and all this kind of thing?" And I just said, "Oh, I was sort of trying to time like my swing better to make connection with the ball." And he said, "Mate, you've never done that." And it was just, and I sort of looked at him and went, "Yeah, you're right. I have never done that." And sort of, in 40 minutes, I hit a few balls and turned around. And you know, at the end of the session, I was hitting it sweetly again. And you sort of wonder, how has that happened to a guy who's 29 years old and played like 200 and something professional games of cricket, just sort of turns around and screws his technique up because he's an idiot? And it sort of just continues to happen like that, you know, if you, you know, put too much pressure on yourself. And I guess that's something I've got to keep a little bit of an eye on moving forward, especially when you have those long periods of time away from home.
Sure.
Oh, hell of a game, cricket.
Great game.
So speaking of the New Zealand environment, you'd obviously be well aware that, you know, since Australia's culture review, Jimmy, you know, which among other things confirmed that only 3 of them knew about ball tampering, the team's now left behind its nasty past, as you know. They shake hands before the match. That's their right. On-field conversation consists entirely of PG-rated content delivered by the captain when the stump mics are on.
Yep.
They prepare for games with things like mindfulness and earthing and elite honesty. So, like, even you guys are the sort of keepers of the great bloke flame. Just wondering if you might be able to explain to us how pleased you are with this. And, you know, like, no doubt your touring colleagues returned home recently with wonderful stories about Australia's newfound authenticity.
What are you laughing at?
Yeah, it's certainly a different type of team to play against than it used to be. But I haven't actually played them in a while, and we've got a series coming up in the next couple of weeks too, so I don't want to put too many things out there. But I think, as I said before, like, different countries have different ways of playing the game, and Aussies sort of as a general group are quite kind of out there and loud and a bit leery, I suppose, compared to their Kiwi brothers. So I suppose that kind of comes across a little bit in the style of cricket. But it's funny, like, we get that kind of I know tag is the nice guys of cricket and that kind of thing, but it's not really an effort to be like that. It's just kind of who most of the blokes are in the team. You look at guys like Kane and Tom and Henry Nicholls and Ross Taylor and those sorts of guys. I mean, I can't imagine them, you know, ever getting angry about anything and raising their voices, whether on the field or not. So I think it's just kind of, I suppose, permeated through to the cricket.
You obviously, so you accept that the Aussies are much nicer than they used to be now. It's definitely not a ruse or anything. No. That'll change once Australia starts winning again.
yeah, I mean, it is what it is. Tim Payne seems like a decent bloke. I haven't actually had a lot to do with him. Obviously, he's had a similar kind of renaissance, I guess, to what I have. So I'm sure we'd be able to exchange a few stories over a beer. But, yeah, in all honesty, they can sort of play their cricket however they like.
Well, he's actually, so keen not to say anything, eh?
Well, we've actually got Tim Payne on the line now, and he joins the call. No. Jimmy,
he just redrew the scouting plan for me for the one day series coming up.
Yeah. Just last one for me in terms of my notes tab of Nisha's tweets. Talking about touring earlier, August 2014, Jimmy, you tweeted an image of your bat with two holes in it, tweeting, "Imagine if your cricket gear went through America and they drilled holes in your bat to look for drugs." What do they find?
Drugs.
It was a great decision from me. Imagine that never
It was
came
amazing,
out.
Actually. I was like, yeah, well played.
you got me. Yeah, fair play.
Yeah. Thankfully, that didn't happen on the way to the Canada League. But that was actually for the Caribbean Premier League, I think, all those years ago. So I hope they weren't drilling the holes in the side of Chris Gayle's bat as well when he was going into that tournament. But it remains to be seen, I guess.
Allegedly. Yeah.
So I just got to ask you a quick one, Jimmy. You spent way more time than we said we would. Early this summer, Neil Wagner referred to Marnus Labuschagne in a press conference, enunciating his name that way, then just subtly inquiring as to why Aussies didn't say it that way. I just sort of want to know how enjoyable it is to often remind Aussies of our social inferiority. And just on a related note, is there any guilt about the fact rugby is now destroyed in this country, largely on account of us not being able to beat the All Blacks?
That surprised me, actually, because, I mean, Australians have long been world-renowned as being tolerant of other cultures, so it would be strange to me that Marnus Labuschagne hasn't found that all that easy to get the translation over, but, I mean, it's spelled exactly like champagne, isn't it? So I suppose that's the easy way. The Aussies can remember it, but Wags is always one to pronounce a word 100% correctly, so I'm sure he was waiting to bring that one out.
Took five for Jimmy, really appreciate your time, mate. I know you've got another interview with a McDonald's drive through, and I just noted going through your tweets ahead of chatting today, as you would have been aware, I saw Vish, a friend of ours, I know he's interviewed you before as well, said after the World Cup to you, you're literally one of the best things about watching and covering cricket, and if kids take cues from you, the game's future's in such good hands, keep doing you. And I don't really have much more to add than that, but I agree with Vish. So congratulations on what you've done so far. There's obviously many more chapters to write, and thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, geez, that's lovely. Thanks, mate.
Apparently they call in the snorkel. Marcus North, hello.
G'day, boys, how are you? The snorkel, I like it. Straight in there.
I'm sure you do.
Obviously, I work in English cricket now with Durham as director of cricket there. And
the so guy, you can't say much.
Can't say too much,
reasons,
but I did get some pleasure this afternoon. So we had some optional training. Mark Wood's injured at the moment, but he was in seeing the physio. And I knew he was in the change room, so I kind of ran in overly excited. And he saw me straight away, and he just looked at me and went, "Fuck off, Northy. I don't want to talk to you." So, yeah.
Hey, Pez, it's fairly obvious that Budgie Smuggler have been a huge support for us this entire summer, to the point where they've also got behind us in the making of our very own set of Budgie Smugglers. What's our second pair, isn't it? And I'm looking at them right now, and it just makes me laugh endlessly.
Without end.
There is no end to the laughter. Richie Beno is shirtless on it. Mitchell Johnson is shirtless in it. So is Bradman. There's Ricky Ponting's forearms. Colin Miller's hair. Mm. Tim Payne's face.
Yeah.
What else is going on here? Bruce Reid, mullet.
It was Bruce Reid's sneer.
Sneer, okay. There's Brett Lee's either glutes or calves. I'm a Brett Lee glute guy myself.
Okay.
I've never seen his calves. Great glutes, though. Power through the crease.
I think we're free to say now that
when we spoke with Richard Cheekwe at our live show in Sydney, he made it very clear that Brett Lee was the most blessed specimen that he had come across athletically, genetically, physically, and read into that what one will.
A real stallion. That surprised me. I'm not sure. I guess I'd never spent that much time thinking about it, but I don't know why it didn't shock me. I didn't gasp. I did later, but not because of that. So yeah, it just surprised me. But yeah, anyway, Brett Lee's on these budgies.
Yeah, well, it makes sense because they're called the Great Australian Rig.
Yeah, the Great Australian Rig.
That's this line of budgies, our second line of budgie smugglers, which is a sentence I imagined 7 years ago when this started. Our second line of budgie smugglers called Great Australian Rigs. You can get them.
Where can you get them?
I believe at budgiesmuggler.com.au.
Pez, let's go right into hashtag RCDC.
Let's go.
Anything to report beforehand? Well, it's that time of year, isn't it? It's that time of year where end of season awards are coming up. Your end of season night is coming up. And if you want us at your end of season awards, get in contact. Hit the emails. Hit the DMs. What's the email? GradeCricketer@gmail.com?
GradeCricketer@gmail.com. Yeah.
Or you go on the website.
If Rodney Hogg's booked out, if Merv's booked out, we can't tell you stories about taking 212 wickets and test wickets and, you know, Javed Mandad calling us a bus inspector and then saying tickets, please.
Yep.
We can't do that with any level of authenticity.
When I did it, it lacked the authenticity that the story deserved. Mm. What's his name? Rodney Hogg ever come to the show? We never found out if he's at the show, the Sydney show, when he sent a tweet in saying, I hope you boys are funny tonight. Oh, yeah, he said, hope you're funny
Which
tonight.
Isn't necessarily saying that he was at the show. He might have just been hoping that we were funny that night.
It was a nice message to receive of support.
It was just a straight public performative sledge.
All in lowercase, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, no always. Punctuation.
That's always the way with a sledge on the net these days.
Rowan Radke writes in to hashtag RCDC. G'day, lads. Indian bloke here living in the US. Thought I'd write to you today as I flaked on a date to go play amateur cricket at the cricket club, which I founded, at my Midwestern American small town uni. Scored 50-odd, 26.
Oh, fucking hell, mate. Jesus Christ.
That's quite a flex.
Yeah.
Scored.
I don't think you can do that.
I don't think you can. Mm. Scored 50 or 26 and got a twofer in a 10-over game playing with other South Asian cricket-starved uni kids and the odd misfit British exchange student. So it was totally worth it and I would do it all over again. Which brings me to my problem. Why is it that every time I'm on a date and sufficiently drunk, I feel the need to impress American chicks who know nothing about cricket with tales of my diving one-handed caught and bowled to dismiss a 50-year-old Indian-American college professor playing tennis ball cricket on a baseball field? Am I destined to never have a long-term relationship in this country, or should I hold out for hope for finding a girl who excuse my cheering and clapping a coldly lofted front foot cover drive at 3 a.m. watching an Indian home game while she tries to sleep? Or should I just move back to India or another cricket-playing nation? I've tried distancing myself from the game, but then India starts spanking some struggling national team in a meaningless bilateral, and I can't resist the urge to watch Bumrah rip through some hapless batting lineup with Kohli swearing in every batter off the pitch. I also can't resist playing meaningless Sunday games against amateur chuckers who are only there because they have nothing better to do, parking every other ball into the bleachers and nicking off blokes with a 20-mile-per-hour leggies. It strokes my ego and helps me mask the fact that I'm actually a shit cricketer who'd get exposed if an actual decent player ever rocked up to my club. Advice appreciated. Also, fuck you for ruining my vocabulary with Aussie slang. Cheers, lads. Brown Yank.
All right. Just to be clear, that's how he signed off.
That's... oh, my God, yeah.
His words.
Yes. Let's be clear on that, please.
Very, very, very clear. I like this question because it's kind of... I mean, I do think it's different to talk about cricket to a woman in an American context because it may have... This is the question I want to pose, right? Okay. Like, if you did it in Australia, that'd be ridiculous and embarrassing. Does cricket in America have... like hipster value or an exotic value?
Yeah.
Probably not, because the US dealt with England on July 4, 1776. So it's probably just an extremely uncool aristocratic game.
Famously.
But interestingly, the first international, as far as I understand, international cricket match was between Canada and the US.
Really?
Yes. And did you know that in the original plans for Central Park in New York, they had laid out on the plans cricket fields? And it is my understanding that cricket was a big sport in the US in the 19th century until A.H. Spalding came along and said real men played baseball.
Fucking Spalding.
Yeah, Spalding killed it.
Fuck.
Could have had Space Jam, could have been a cricket movie.
Okay, so let's answer Rowan's question by now talking about who would be in Space Jam. Let's get into that.
When Space Jam came out, so that would have been the early mid-90s.
So Boomer is straight in there for me.
What? Oh, right, for now.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, okay, so you want to do 90s?
Well, I don't actually care.
Because they're doing the reboot now, because LeBron James has just done Space Jam 2.
Okay, well, so we should do both.
We can do both. Let's now spend half an hour figuring out who's in the team.
Mid-90s.
Joffre Archer's in it.
Okay,
probably
right,
one of the coolest men on the team.
Joffre, yeah, okay.
Is Pat Cummins in your team?
Yeah, probably. I mean, Cummins is probably the Aussie player. It could be Smith. It could be Cummins. Yeah. It could be... And then, yeah, you'd have Coley, obviously. You'd have Stokes.
I've got Kyron Pollard.
Why?
In my team.
But he's... I mean, Space Jam is about, like, the best players.
Yeah, I'm going for a bit of brand capacity there.
People don't know who Kyron Pollard is.
That's the funniest sentence that's ever been said in the show. People know who Kyron Pollard is.
Not in the Space Jam context.
You telling me that if you walked into a Baby G Shock Watch shop, people aren't going to know who Kyron Pollard is.
Why am I in a Baby G Shock Watch shop?
That's the first question I'm asking you.
Right. Cool. All right. We can get your submissions later on who would be Space Jam both both first Space Jam and reboot for cricket.
Because Bradman's not in it. Bradman's not in Space Jam.
What are you doing? Yeah, what? Pre-World War II Space Jam. Larwood, Bradman, Verity, Ponsford.
They play against the Dutch East Indies.
The Monstars.
Yeah, the Monstars, yeah.
Well, hang on. Why does he do this? Why does he do this to himself? He goes.
Oh, well.
Why does he talk to women on dates?
Because it's something that he deeply cares about. That's why. So it's a passion project. It's not a project. It's just a thing that he really likes. That's why he does it. So
we'd also need to know what else he does, because he might not have anything else in his life.
But if he's watching,
what country he's in?
Also, why wouldn't you be clapping and hooting and hollering watching a Coley? Like, any shot over cover in the air just looks so good. Ian Bell was good at that. Ian Bell was good at lots of things.
Is he in your Space Jam team?
No, but Shane Lee is.
Anonymous writes in, lads, please keep this one anonymous. I recently turned 18, meaning that next season I will be able to properly circuit with my teammates in the second 11 of my local club. Yeah. I have heard on the grapevine that graduation to the circuiting world requires a small initiation ceremony involving chinning a few pints, brackets, no biggie, close brackets, and also telling a funny sex story. Mm-hmm. Herein lies my dilemma. Not only do I have no funny sex stories, I have no sex stories at all. What should I do? If I concocted an elaborate lie, I could earn the deeply craved approval of my teammates. However, this runs the risk of being found out. I am confident if one of the more intimidating older lads stared me down and said, "That's bullshit, mate," that I, lacking any backbone, would crumple under his alpha gaze. Just thinking about this deeply embarrassing scenario, never mind experiencing it, has kept me up at night this past week. This would be so soul-crushingly humiliating that I'd be forced to leave the club. How would I explain this to Dad? You know, inverted commas. I tried to earn the approval of other men by lying about the fact I've had sex. He couldn't possibly think lower of me after that. Alternatively, I could try to own my own virginity. Perhaps there's some respect to being earned, if I do that. However, I envisage that this option will also have the long-lasting and potentially emotionally damaging consequences. First, I would, of course, be mocked mercilessly. On top of this, though, I fear that the mockery would enlarge the taboo of losing my virginity so much so that when I finally end up in bed with a woman, I wouldn't be able to concentrate on the matter at hand, only on the hurtful comments, on the what's it like being 18 and your closest sexual partner's being Kleenex in your old socks.
Oh, my God.
Christ.
Oh, my God.
I might never have sex because I'd always panic, thinking that this is the one opportunity to end the mocking. My future's in your hands here, lads. What should I do? Cheers.
My God. Okay, that's a confused young man. And
he's being honest, though. He's saying I'm a virgin and I don't want to be mocked for being a virgin. What should I do? Should I lie about being a virgin?
Yeah.
Or lie about not being a virgin, or just own up to it?
Yeah. And
what do you say?
And Brett Daniels, we appreciate you writing in.
That's not his name. To Brett Daniels. Yeah. There as well.
What if that's just in my subconscious that I've read a question from? Anyway, that's not him. Like, it's just that time. Like, I feel like sex is on the mind heavily for him. I feel like that. Yeah,
you're 18.
He's written. Yeah, because he's written the 800 word thing about having sex and wanting to. I think he wants to do it more because he's scared of his friends. which is probably a bigger issue. Also, like, let's
say... Well, you want to get it out of the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Some do.
Yeah.
I'm not encouraging it, but I'm saying he just wants to...
Be gone.
He wants the monkey off the back.
Get rid. Isn't it a weirder thing, though? Like, if let's say you and I are in a stretching circle, right? And there's nine other blokes around. And then,
yes.
And then I say, oh, yeah, had sex last night. And then you call out.
If you use it in those words.
and then you call out to me in front of our nine other teammates. Pff, bullshit, mate. Like, that's fucking huge balls from you to just call that out. Like, that's a lie.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a view on this. I think that... like, cricketers are largely they're actually nice people at heart, who have been conditioned into a false alpha mode as a misguided coping mechanism. And, like, given you'll be talking, like, this young man will be talking about the most primal of subjects, sex. What's more likely, I think, if he owns up to his virginity, if he does it in a way that is, like, honest and kind of self-deprecating, he's going to find a senior player and make sure it's the right senior player.
Why does he have to own up to it? I'll let you finish.
Well, he's saying that he's going to be asked if you've got any funny sex stories as an initiation. So let's just, for the hypothetical, let's just say he's asked that question.
Okay.
Right? I don't actually think that happens, but anyway.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah, but anyway, he's worried about it.
Hey, mate, you're 17. Got any funny sex stories?
Yeah, but there are guys who'll do something or try and draw it out of you.
Mm.
And, like, I think that what he'll find is if he's honest about it and self-deprecating about it or whatever and just say, it is how it is. I'm keen to get off the mark. Or, and don't say that, actually. God, I'm all over the place. He's going to find some senior player will actually take him under his wing.
I'm not sure you want that either.
No, and my next point was make sure it's the right person taking you under your wing, not someone who calls themselves a Chop King or whatnot, and actually that's usually a self-bestowed nickname that is a lie.
Yeah.
You know,
it's all
clear as mud.
Mate, yeah, fuck, it's confusing, isn't it?
That's clear
really
as mud.
Confusing. Let us know how you get in. Get on, though, Brett.
On.
Oh, Christ. Steve Stevens writes in. Lads, if this isn't the most feel-good cricket story you hear this year, I'll eat my hat. It's a longish one, so needs a DM. A new kid started in my 10-year-old school class last week. Let's call him Bobby. He's been living overseas with his family for the last 4 years. He decided he wanted a game of cricket, and so he joined my son's cricket team, even though there were only 3 matches left in the season, and even though they hadn't won a single match all season, or even got close, and it was starting to get them down. Bobby and his dad arrived at the match last Saturday, and Bobby's dad immediately volunteered to score, and had brought his own pencil case to do so. Apparently he liked doing it. Huge tick from the other parents. Bobby told us he'd played a bit in when they were overseas, but the players weren't very good. Great, the kids thought. Enthusiastic, but not very good. Perfect.
Mm.
My boys' team bowled first, and Bobby wicket kept as he fancied to go. It was immediately obvious he was the best keeper in the team. Very tidy and looked a natural. Good start. They swapped keepers after 15 overs, as they do, and after 5 minutes in the field, he took a fantastic outfield catch off my son's bowling. Very few catches are taken at this age. Best catch of the season. Kids seemed promising. Then he bowled, and he was the fastest in their team, and just about the fastest bowler from any side all season. Accurate too, and took wickets. Great, we thought. They found a strike bowler who can field. At the change of innings, Bobby asked all the other kids whether they dared him to hit a six when he batted.
Ooh.
They did, of course, so he smiled and said, "All right, I will."
Ooh.
Offside now, the 10-year-old boy speaking there.
With more
confidence than I thought was warranted. Some parents, including me, especially me, told him to settle down, play safe, and just try not to get out in his first game.
Attacking instincts.
They needed to chase about 130 on a wet field with long grass. A Herculean ask. Long story short, they lost all their wickets except Bobby for about 30. They were 100 behind, and I packed up and got ready to go. In this cricket, you retire after facing 30 balls or getting 30 runs. But if there are overs left and you don't have a full team, they were missing a player, the non-out batsman can keep batting and another kid has to stay at the non-striker's end and run for him. Generally, this doesn't last long. Bobby was a not-out batsman, so he kept batting and it was one of the most remarkable innings I've ever seen. When it was a good ball, he just manipulated his wrists and steered it into the gap and ran a single with the most confident yep I've ever heard.
Spelled Y-E-R-P.
Yeah. When it was short, he pulled it over square leg for four. When it was pitched up, he drove it through a gap from mid-wicket all the way around to cover point, wherever it needed to go, and he played every other conventional shot there was as required. At some point, he registered his 50 and acknowledged the crowd like it was a packed SCG. It seemed completely practiced, yet strangely natural. As this progressed, the other team started getting annoyed at him and even though they are 10, sledged him with, "That's great and everything, but you can't hit a six." He smiled at them and announced, "I can." And the very next ball, he launched it into the trees. And then he pointed at his teammates on the side of the oval who had dared him to hit a six earlier. It was at this point that I thought the kid might be Viv Richards or possibly Stokes after his fielding and bowling. They needed 11 to win of the last two overs with Bobby on 80 not out. Parents and children and opposition and home side alike were beside themselves. Could Bobby turn up as a 10-year-old in his first ever game of cricket in this country? Because that's what we would all be thinking and aiming for, but not Bobby. The kid had a job to do. Putting aside all ego, he kept eerily calm, hit the bad ones and made sure of the win. With two balls left in the match and playing, having run 30 minutes over its scheduled finish time, mainly because the opposition dad umpiring was captaining for about the last third of the innings, like the umpires in Dodd Bradman miniseries in Young Don's first game with the adults. Bobby brought up the winning runs and was left on 87 not out. Everyone went crazy, literally lost their minds, except Bobby and Bobby's dad. And with that, my boys' side had won their first game of the season with 10-year-old left-handed Bobby putting on 100 partnership with himself to get them home. Bobby had won a match, had won friends and admiration, and likely made sure his teammates wanted to play again next year. And he did it all with his dad scoring and watching every ball. And so, as you would expect, my hashtag AskTGC question is, how the fuck do I alpha Bobby's dad?
Oh, it's a wonderful story, Steve, so thank you for writing in. That's very good. Yeah. He's like, and that boy's name was Ben Stokes. Well, you don't really alpha him now that you've like lionized him in podcast form. I think it's impossible to come back from that. But yeah, wonderful story, wonderful cricket story. And yeah, obviously a complete gun of a player who needs to be brought down to size immediately.
Yeah. Well, for Bobby, and I presume it's Bobby Quiney, that's as good as it's ever going to get. That's as good as it's ever going to get. He put a 100-run partnership with himself.
That's amazing.
His dad was watching. That's who bought a pencil case.
Yeah.
This kid's either going to play test cricket or he should quit immediately and, you know, go through a growth spurt. So what am I saying there, Pez?
I don't know.
Quit cricket and get massive.
I want to read this last one here, guys. I know it's a little bit long. Can we just do it? Just to completely contrast from that wonderful cricket story.
Yeah, let's do
all
it.
All right, Sean Hurley just writes in. We don't have to talk too much after. Sean Hurley writes in. I just giggled reading this. G'day, gents. After 25-odd years of service, 22 years, I have recently left the military. One of the things that I plan to do with my newly found and much appreciated time is return to playing cricket. The last time I played cricket was 1997 in whatever competition existed in Port Macquarie for 17-year-olds shortly before I joined the army. I'm currently working my way through the back catalogue of the cast while keeping up to date with the new eps as they come in. As I haven't listened to everything yet, I apologise if the subject of this, possibly way too long, correspondence has been brought up before. After reading your book and numerous tweets alongside hearing you boys talk, I have come to a conclusion. Grade cricket and the military are the same thing. I could go on all day with a number of anecdotes to back this up, but in the interest of keeping things short, sort of, things sort of brief, I'll try for a few direct comparisons. The Special Forces are international/state players. You rarely see them, and when you do, they are usually wearing a beret or a t-shirt that denotes they are Special Forces. They do this while not saying much to anyone who isn't Special Forces, and they also get the majority of funding allocated to defence. The infantry are first graders. They champ everyone, more on that later. Everything revolves around them, and they all wish they were somewhere else with a real job because no matter how much this one hates them, and they hate it, they can't get away from it or some shit. All the other Army Corps and are 2nd to 5th graders. Their rigs are becoming more and more sloppy as time goes on. They also hate their job and can't get out of it, and their job not only hates them, it consistently reminds them they are nothing compared to 1st graders and really they should just give up. The Navy, to quote Higos, is some fucking park shit. They wear camouflage uniforms with reflector tabs on them and actually have a rank of Chief Petty Officer, which gets shortened to Chief. So yes, you have a bunch of 20-year-olds running around calling 40-year-old men Chief and they think that is normal. The Air Force is, who fucking knows, some friendly corporate rec league lunch match where everyone gets a medal. In saying this, all the others are jealous of them because they enjoy themselves, love their job, and don't give up after 8 years. Officers are club presidents/administrators. They are useless, corrupt, have no idea what they are doing, but have all the power over who does what. Alphaing definitely exists, but with a slightly different context and can be surpassed by the rank structure. For example, while the concept is rife, no one uses the word champ. To use the word champ is to invite violent physical reprisal. Instead, much more friendly phrases are used to assert dominance over those who you have already dominance over due to your rank. To use a personal example, upon arriving to Singleton, For basic infantry training in 1998, still a 17-year-old, I was greeted by a corporal with, "What the fuck are you looking at, cunt eyes?"
Oh my god.
Kit. Early on in my career, the government issued kit was trash, and I spent a vast amount of my own money in order to be kitted out properly and not look yuck. Special forces get all the good kit without even asking for it or needing it. Showers. Just as in modern grade cricket, things are a little different now. But when I joined the army, there were no cubicles or doors in the shower blocks. Rig-based selections. It goes without saying that in an environment where physical dominance is often required for part of the job, that this is a thing. I could go on, lads, as there are so many more similarities, but I'm unsure you probably haven't made it this far. Just to make this a question. Thoughts? Keep up the great work, guys. It's a pleasure to read and listen. Sean. He's out of the army.
Well, I just want to say to Sean, firstly, I've never said anything disparaging about the Navy.
I think he meant you to say.
No, yeah. Sean, thank you for your service. And thank you to thank all you the fourth graders out there for your service, going out there, defending your community against the other communities out there on a Saturday afternoon when it's 3 for 380 and they brought a fucking shit tea. You ever go to Special Forces and go, "Hey, got any spare rifles?" See you next week.